Hello, and welcome to Media Mavens. This is episode 23. I am Pam, and with me, as always, is Riley.
Hello.
How you doing, Riley?
Pretty good. Yeah. Like a relaxed weekend this weekend, so.
That's good.
Yeah.
It's always nice. My last two weekends have been pretty relaxed after hectic for the last few weeks, so.
Yeah, well, you deserve them.
Exactly. So our guest today is Yusuf Cole. Welcome.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Oh, great. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. Just, another relaxing weekend for me as well. So
excellent.
I'm into it. I love the weekends, as I'm sure mm-hmm. we all do.
We're going to be talking in our second segment about the film Arrival, along with an article that Yusuf wrote about Arrival and Mass Effect. But before we get to that, do you want to talk about yourself a little bit, Yusuf? Tell people what you do, who you are?
Sure. I'm known as YumiYu on Twitter, and that's where I think most of my video game connections are, because in real life, I mostly do graphic design with people who don't play video games. I mean, there's some overlap, but very little. But yeah, I do a lot of graphic design for television, so like animation stuff, like moving titles, moving imagery. If you see like a commercial that has a lot of like animation in it, I probably it's something similar to what I work on. And it's like a pretty fun job and very creative. And sometimes it gets informed by my video game habits. Like I did a commercial for X-Men last year that like was all 8-bit style. So they were Yusuf, if you play video games, you can direct this. And I was like, yes, finally, it pays off.
That's cool.
And for games, I have been getting into writing more for games websites like Paste and Waypoint and Zam, which is really awesome. So kind of like last year was like the first year that I've been making actual money off of it. Like I've been blogging mostly for a few years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just a nice side gig, essentially, where I'm playing a game and then waiting until an idea hits. So I kind of have the luxury of like having a normal job, because it's pretty hard to actually turn writing about video games into a paying job that you can rely on.
Right.
So it's kind of very much like a side thing for me, but I'm very much enjoying working on it.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you also have a podcast.
Yes. Video Game Hour with my friend Tavit. Yeah, we started that like almost 2 years ago. It's been a while. Yeah, we record very infrequently, like about once a month to 2 months, just because we're both super busy normally and like in our 30s. Mm-hmm. And just like, trying to like balance that with, because the podcast, we're basically the focus of it is we both play a game, one game, and then we talk about that game for approximately an hour. And we try and bring like interesting perspectives that like maybe haven't been covered necessarily, and some kind of maybe multidisciplinary approach where we like talk about what literature is similar to the game or what like real life event or something like that. Just to try and make the conversation a bit more elevated than just like, it was fun, the mechanics were good, bye. essentially is like the goal of the podcast. Sometimes we get there. And it's really fun to work to record with him, because I feel like working on the podcast has like helped me grow my ability to discuss games and to come up with like neat ideas that then parlay into my writing about them for websites. So it's like really helped me in terms of language and discussion.
Yeah, it's often I find a lot better to actually like talk to someone voice to voice and have a conversation about games rather than, you know, on the internet where it doesn't exactly flow as well.
Pretty much, yeah. Like I was on forums for a while and I've kind of completely stopped using forums. Like Twitter Twitter has mostly replaced that, and it allows me to like maybe say a few words about a game and then kind of go away. Like instead of like being on a forum where you can get into these long drawn out discussions that sometimes feel fruitless at the end of the day. And I agree that like talking really it's just more, it feels more like you actually can see each other's points more clearly and come to some kind of consensus or conclusion at the end of the conversation.
Yeah, I really enjoy your podcast. I really like the one that you did on Inside. I actually mentioned that on an episode of this a while back. And I really like the Undertale episode, because that's a game that I didn't like playing at all, but I really like hearing people talk about.
So you're similar to my co-host, Tavi, who did not like playing it.
Yeah, exactly.
which came across in the episode. Yeah. It's better when we like come at it from different angles, and have different like perspectives on a game. Like I think one of my favorite older episodes we did was for the Talos Principle, which was like a game that I really liked, and then he super hated.
Oh,
that was like one of the few times that we've like really like been like just coming up from really different directions, and then like. A lot came out of it, and it's like, why exactly don't you like it? And like, kind of coming, like figuring out, like that it was because, like, primarily of the style of the narrative delivery rather than the narrative itself. Like, just like the fact that like the game has you kind of basically playing in the Garden of Eden, and like it just has very like heavy-handed religious symbology that just is like the heavy-handedness of it that like he was like recoiling against. Because then he went on to like really like Jonathan Blow's game, The Witness, which is very similar in like structure, but then like is a lot more. It's like basically where like the Talos Principle is like Christian, the Witness is like Buddhist, and so like that difference in framing made it just so much more enjoyable for him. So I found that really interesting, and that wouldn't have come out if we hadn't like been talking about both games a lot on our podcasts.
Right. Oh, that's cool. All right, so we will talk about what we've been up to in the last, week or two, any games we've been playing or shows we've been watching or books we've been reading. Yusuf, did you want to kick it off?
Sure. Yeah, I've been playing. It's been hard. I've been very busy. So, like, these games go back a little bit. But I've been playing Hitman, and I'm trying to play more of it, but it's like, I kind of wish I had been playing it when it was episodical. Because I really, basically it's a game that came out last year in episodes. Like, I think once every few months they release a new map. And, like, the way Hitman works is, like, you're in a town or a house or a mansion, like, and you have to kill a target, and then you're, like, it's a sandbox otherwise. So it works really well for episodical, because you can just, like, give the player a mansion, and then, like, they explore that for a month or so, and then they can put it down. But at the end of the year, they released all of the six or seven levels together, and it's been really good. I just like just don't have enough time to like go through all of them, because they're all very dense and rich, because they're meant to be played like once at a time. So right. I'm like halfway through it, but it's just I just really like it, and I like it as someone who didn't like the earlier ones very much. I played like Blood Money, which was like the one that everyone says is the best. And it was just like super, it's a very awkward game where the controls are very weird and you die a lot, and it's all about dying a lot to like figure out what is the right way to like to execute your target. And they've improved a lot since then, where basically it's just a lot more player friendly in this iteration, because one, they actually have like on-screen hints that tell you how, like, what are some of the cool ways you can kill your target, like, instead of just, like having to figure it out on your own. So it's, like, you can, like, hey, look at that camera over there. You can, like, put a bomb on it, so then when the recorder, like, records the guy, it'll blow up, and it's, like, yes, I want to go do that, and then it tells you exactly how to do it. And you're, like, this is amazing, because, like, otherwise you had to try so many different ways to get it to work, and, like, just, like, bang your head against the wall. And so it sidesteps a lot of that, and just, like, makes it, like, a game like a lot more in line with more modern games, where like you can walk around the level and hear people talk about ways that might be like things that are methods that might be effective.
Oh,
it kind of creates like little mini missions, like how like in Skyrim where you walk around, you overhear people, and then you get a mission. So it actually happens in Hitman, where you could just like wander around the level, and then people like to say like, oh, the target likes to go to the bathroom like every half an hour, and then like you kind of get that big clue, and then you like can set up your whole scheme from there. So yeah, it's an and the schemes are just really, really fun to execute. Like, they're all like the standard ones, like, you know, drop all the stage lights on somebody giving a speech, or like blow them up in various ways. And the camera one from the first mission, which was Paris, was my favorite one because it basically goes like this: like, you have to kill this like fashion designer who's also like an evil dude, because they're all like cartoonishly evil people.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also like a very narcissistic personality, and like he loves getting interviewed. And there's like a camera woman who her camera is like missing the lens, or is missing a component, so you can like help her, but in doing that you can like also put a bomb in the camera so that like when she goes outside to interview him, and you don't even have to be anywhere near the interview, so you're like watching through a window, and then she like puts the camera down to go get a call, take a call, and then he's with it, and you just blow him up, and it's so spectacular. And no one knows it's you. It's like it's always the best assassinations when it's like you're not anywhere near him, and you're just like press a little button and then walk away very slowly.
That sounds cool. Yeah, I've been wanting to pick that up. It's interesting what you said about the episodic thing, because I remember when it was first announced, the reception about that wasn't particularly good. And I find that in a lot of episodic games, which are mostly like the Telltale things, which are very narrative heavy, playing it episode by episode and waiting that 2 to 3 months between everyone sort of ruins it for me. But yeah, it seems like it fits a lot better here.
Yeah, I think it does, because there is a narrative, but it's super backgrounded. It's not important at all. Like, and it's really just about the puzzle box that you're unlocking. Like, you're just like, oh, you're unfolding this cool mission, and you're finding different ways to what this new mission has in store for you. Like, and that's completely separate from the overarching narrative. So actually, yeah, I agree. I think it works better for a game like Hitman than even stuff like, you know, Kentucky Route Zero, which I really like, and then I get really annoyed when I have to wait for like the game to release in a few years. Which is an extreme example.
I haven't even started that because I want to play it all at once.
Yeah, totally get that reasoning, and I wish I had done the same kind of, because I'm like at this point I feel like I need to start it again, just because it's been so long since I've like played like the last chapter that I'm just like I kind of forgot everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar to like Game of Thrones, where like I read all the books and then I promptly forgot everything that happened in the books, like, and I'm just like, there's another book coming out, but I don't think I'm gonna be ready to read it.
I don't think I would be either. Like, I don't know, there's just so much in those first books that it's like,
you know.
Yeah, there's a lot to remember. And I've definitely been conflating the books with the show. Like, I don't know what is from what anymore.
Yeah, I feel the last season probably ruined me for the books, because I've heard it was like different than the books. So I'm just like, what?
Uh-huh,
what happened to each person? Will one person be alive in one universe and dead in another universe?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think they already are.
That's true.
Like, the differences, unless like the new book is the similar to the show. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it's tangential. I could go on that topic for a while. also, I'm playing Persona 4 Golden. I think that's what it's called. It has a lot of names. Have either of you played that?
I have not. I've only played a tiny bit of Persona 3. That's my whole Persona experience.
Yeah, I don't even know how that one is, like, or it, like what it plays like. It's like a JRPG as well, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I picked it up because I got a Vita a few years ago, and it's like it's my first handheld in a while.
Mm.
I just heard that this was the game to play if you had a Vita, so I like got it, and my trepidation is that I don't play a lot of JRPGs anymore. Like, I played them a lot in high school, and I feel like it kind of fits that lifestyle where like you just have a lot of free time, and I don't so much anymore. So I was a little bit worried about like what might happen, or like if I'd fall off of it really quickly. And it's actually kept my interest a lot longer than I thought it would. And I think because it does a really good job of giving you a lot of different things to do that are interesting and like not just repetitive. Like it has its regular fight scene or fight areas where you just fight a lot of enemies, but they're interspersed with like kind of you role playing like a high school kid. So there's like romances and friendships, and there's also tests. And the tests are actually pretty clever because like the teacher will like ask you a question during class scenes, and then like it'll be kind of like a random, like kind of like a trivia style question. Like, what is this, like which of these is the name of a river? And it's like the Piss River, and I guess that's like a real river or something. and then you kind of do other stuff, and then like in a few games, in a few sessions, it comes back to it and you take like a final exam where like you have to like have remembered a lot of the questions that they're asked you throughout the game as a way to like kind of ensure that you're paying attention. I think it's a really interesting way to ensure that you're paying attention to like to dialogue boxes, because a lot of times you can just like skip through them really fast.
Yeah, just hold the button down.
Yeah, but when you're in the classroom, you should not do that. Because I mean, I don't know like what I've been able to pass all my tests, so I don't know what happens if you fail everything. Apparently you have to go to summer school.
Oh no.
Which is kind of amazing. But now I'm kind of mad that I didn't go to summer school, because they're like, I want, like, now that I'm like, I'm having my summer vacation right now, and I can't go into the school, which has like some mission like items and quest givers that I can't access. So that's interesting. Like, I'm like, I wish I had failed. But the game is like mainly about creating like cool relationships, or creating like strong relationships with like your friends, and that then affects their battle readiness. It's actually, Mass Effect has some overlap with that and some like parallels, because like you kind of, the game encourages you to like hang out with different team members, and then just like talk with them and help them with their problems, which are very like normal like teenage problems, like, you know, like about their parents or facing responsibilities and growing up. And then if you hang out with them enough, that you increase your level of friendship, and then you like everybody has like personas, which are basically just like, I guess, magical animals that are spirits that fight for you, and those will get stronger if your friendship gets stronger.
Cool.
So it's just like a cool back and forth where you're like, okay, this, I'm in the battle mode, and that's its own thing, and it's like there's a cool strategy there, and like it keeps it interesting where like different enemies have different weaknesses, and you just have to like figure out what those weaknesses are and then use the proper skill on the proper enemy. And then a whole other aspect of it, which is like completely just like high school role play, but like done in a pretty smart way, and like the dialogue options are nuanced in a way that you can't just like always pick the good one. Like a lot of it's just like people asking you for advice, and then giving, and you being able to give like three very vague answers, and sometimes like they pay off and sometimes not. So there's a challenge there, and not just like you're great or like I don't care about you. There's actually like some nuance there. So it's a pretty smart game, and it's a really good Subway game. So like which is where I mainly use my Vita, just like on rides to work, because I have a long trip. Just from based on where I live in New York, is a very big city, and the trains are very slow.
It's always good to have something to pass the time like that, then.
Yes, definitely. And the other game I've been playing is Dishonored 2, and kind of wrapping that up, I've been playing it a lot. Like, I played a lot over the winter. I super, super enjoyed it. I like Dishonored 1 a lot, and Dishonored 2 just kind of improves on Dishonored 1 in every aspect, partially by giving another character that has like a whole different skill set, because like in the first game you play as Corvo, and this one you still play as Corvo and have similar skills, but you can also play as his daughter Emily, who is like kind of has some overlap, but mostly is like has her own skill set, where like it's a little bit more like nuanced and I think stealth focused, and you can like chain enemies together so that when you like what you do to one enemy will like affect all the enemies, and you can like turn into a shadow form and like sneak around like this creepy like shadow on the floor.
Nice.
Yeah, and like whereas Corvo is a lot more like goes in pretty loud. And yeah, I don't know what it is about the environment and the world of Dishonored, but I just love spending time in it. Like I think that they do a really great job with the sound design and the art direction. That it's like, and it's a game that, I mean, you could play as an action-y adventure game, but you can also play it very, very stealthily. That alone, like, gives it so much replayability. So I've played through it once semi-stealthy, where, like, if I get caught, I'll fight the guards, and but I'll try and keep it. You can basically, the two endings are low chaos or high chaos, and you can still kill people and, like, have a low chaos ending as long as you don't kill a lot. Mm-hmm. And then the second one, I was like, I'm going to kill every single person. It's not like the Undertale, like, evil ending where you just, like, I just killed everybody. And that was fun, too, because it's like you have all these ridiculous skills that will just, like, cause all this mayhem. And now I'm going through a playthrough where I'm trying to do it. There's, like, a challenge where you can go through it without ever being detected or have killed anybody. Oh. It's like ghost and, like, I forgot what it's like, ghost and stealthy or something, or like non-violent. And that one's really fun because I just love the role-playing style idea of, like, just thinking about how this looks for the bad guys, where they're just, like, wandering around and they're like, oh yeah, you're the person you're protecting is gone or, like, dead, and, like, you don't know what happened, and you'll never know what happened, and, like, some of you woke up, like, lying on top of each other on a couch somewhere, and that's, like, and you don't know why that happened either. It's just, like, yeah, just messing with their minds. As opposed to just being, like, a standard thing where they're like, oh, that bad person got to us. Like, what if you don't even know if there ever was a bad person? Like, there's this level halfway through that's really famous, like, the Clockwork Mansion, that's kind of very Bioshock-inspired, where, like, there's, like, a villain who's, like, talking to you the whole time while you're kind of trying to get through his nefarious traps. And if you can, there's a way to do it so that he doesn't ever, like, find out you're in the house. And so he just you can totally, you're like, oh, you have no opportunity to gloat to me because I've completely sidestepped, like, your senses, essentially, or your surveillance.
Huh. Cool.
Yeah, it has a lot of flexibility. I think that's why it's also so fun to play.
I feel like a lot of people have been talking about that game on Twitter lately. Like, I've seen a few people talking about playing it or wanting to finish it. And they all talk about playing Emily, as Emily.
Yeah, I'd like to play it too. It sounds like it's really neat.
Yeah, I recommend it. What's interesting about it is, like, you get out of it what you put into it in a way that some other games don't. I don't know. It's a game that's very, very open and pliable, which can be disappointing if you want it to guide you. Or, like, Hitman, like, was really, like, gives you very clear direction of what it wants you to do. Like, Hitman, you, like, it doesn't want you to fight anybody ever, because if you, like, get into a gunfight, it's just the worst game, because aiming is hard and, like, it sucks, and, like, the enemies don't react to your bullets. It's just, like, not fun. But then, like, Dishonored, like, I mean, you can play Dishonored where you kind of, like, because you have this skill that allows you to warp really far, you can just, like, warp past everybody and get the objective in, like, 5 minutes, and then you're done with the level. And, like, that could be a fun challenge, but also, like, if you do that and you didn't want to do that, you're like, oh, this game sucks, because, like, nothing happened. So you can, like, it allows that. So, like, it doesn't, like, force you into any kind of engagement. And also, a lot of people, like, kind of approach it as a stealth game and get really annoyed because it's, you know, like any stealth game, you get spotted a lot. And, like, that can be really, not fun. And I always tell people, like, don't sweat it. Like, you don't have to play as a stealth game. Like, it's super fun as a, like, regular action game. Like, it gives you all the tools for that. The sword fighting is fun. And you have, like, cool escape mechanisms. So, like, it's not like you have to, like, stand there and shoot every enemy. You can, like, attack one and then, like, blink away and they don't know where you went. And then, like, you continue on your way. So, like, I think it's about expectations, really.
I think that was my problem, because I played the first Dishonored a little bit, and I heard about this high chaos, low chaos thing, and I was like, okay, well, I have to do it and never kill anyone. And that lasted for about 20 minutes, and then I just, like, I can't do this. It's too hard. I don't have the patience for the stealth, so I just ended up quitting entirely.
Yep, totally understandable. Like, I have, like, a ridiculous amount of patience for restarting stealth games. Yeah. So that kept me through it, where I was like, I don't know, like, stuff like the Deus Ex game, like the new ones, where it's like, I'm like, I can't be spotted. And like, I'll just like save scum my way through all of it. And it's like not everybody's cup of tea. And
just I'm just sitting in air vent all day.
Exactly. I'm here to say you don't have to do that for Dishonored. Right. It's totally fine to not do that and kill everybody. And like, and the game supports that narratively, like especially in Dishonored 2, where like, I guess Dishonored 1 as well. I mean, you were Dishonored, so of course you're gonna be mad. And like, in Dishonored 2 especially, because it starts with you being betrayed by half of your guard.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just like, oh, you, like that's you guys are the worst. Like, I feel not bad at all killing you. And I feel like it's less heavy-handed in the second one about if you do high chaos, the ending doesn't matter as much. And like the only things that change are like what your own characters say. That could be really fun because in the first game, your character never speaks, which was like, you know, a kind of a standard game protagonist decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But in the second one, I think they tried to mix it up a bit and have the characters like react to the environment. And the way they do it depends on how you play it. So if you're like playing it more violently, your character is just like a bloodthirsty maniac. They're just like, oh, look at that bridge. I wish I could throw somebody off of that bridge. You're like, what? Why did you say that? And so on. That could be fun. Like, and it's like, yeah, it's less... Like, the first game literally has an NPC who, like, will just chastise you the whole time if you're being bad. And this one, like, doesn't have that. So it's, like, it's a lot less, like, hitting you over the head with morality.
Right. Don't judge me, game.
Exactly. Don't give me these tools and then say, like, I'm bad for using them. So I think they learned a lesson on that front.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that's what I've been playing. Do you want me to talk about what I've been watching?
Sure, you can talk about whatever you like.
Yes, I will. I will then. Yeah, I've been watching, for television, I've been watching Empire, which is like a pretty hilarious and over-the-top show. We started watching it, me and my wife, because we went to see Hidden Figures, and which is really good. And it has Taraji P. Henson, I forget her last name, but she's the main character of Hidden Figures, and of one of three. She's like plays this like super nerdy, like quiet scientist, mathematician who's just like very, very like. I mean, she has some moments where she kind of like lets it loose, and that's like really entertaining. Only like primarily in juxtaposition to like her nerdiness and her quietness, and being like very introverted, and then. I was like, when we started watching Empire, and she plays Cookie, who's like this out of control like character who's so hammy and fun, and just like basically plays like this like music media mogul, like who's just like very like sassy and over the top, and like always doing one liners and just like snapping back at people, and is like such a fun juxtaposition and such a fun difference, and you're like. They should give her Oscar for Hidden Figures, like after, and like they should also watch Empire, as homework, just to show like how flexible she is as an actor. You're like, how is this the same person? Yeah, she's just so like bodacious and over the top and like very like bombastic, and so that's really fun watching that change, I guess. Though she was like, I guess Empire came first, but yeah, and it's just like a goofy show that you can kind of. Turn your brain off, and it has some good music because it's like a music label, so they have artists that like sing during some of the episodes.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so like you're gonna have, I mean, like they had Alicia Keys on, they had like Mariah Carey in the last season, which is pretty cool. And that's really fun to watch, and just like the regular people they have on the show is fun too. And then we kind of like, you can like root for different characters because they all have their own weirdness, and like they do a good job of like having them all have their own dramatic arcs that constantly rise and fall, because the stories about like Lucius Lyons, who's like the owner of this empire, of this like music label, and he has like his family, like Cookie's his ex-wife, and then he has like three sons, and then the sons, he's like trying to groom them to replace him, and they all have their own like specific like dramatic, I guess, problems that they have to solve. Like one son is bipolar, one son is gay, and the other son is just like spoiled. And then like they just like constantly play very like hammily on those like on those plot devices like over and over again, and then they all have different relationships with Lucius. Like, sometimes he's not their friend, sometimes he, like, completely backstabs them. So you just have, like, a lot of, like, fun moments where you're just like, no, you're being stupid, you're making a terrible decision. Actually, that's, like, every episode. The characters are making, like, really weird decisions that are clearly just for the dramatic, like, potential, and not something that a human being would make.
I feel like that happens in a lot of shows.
That's true. I guess because maybe the show just, like, it doesn't take it as seriously. It's, like, less obviously bad. Like, right. It's just, like, very much, like, you know what we're doing. And you're here for the ride. You're not here to, like, see a character drama. Like, this is about, like, just, like, rooting at your television set. And I watched I'm Not Your Negro 2 nights ago. And, yeah, that's a documentary about James Baldwin. And it's just, like, amazing. It's an amazing documentary because James Baldwin is a very magnetic, he was a very magnetic figure, and, like, it has a lot of his speeches, and then also has, like, Samuel L. Jackson doing the narration. So it's just, like, a lot of, like, very strong voices being heard, and it's good. It's really well done because it does a good job at, like, taking archival footage from, like, the 60s and civil rights, and then, like, mixing it with footage from today, like, from the past few years. And just showing how, like, some things have changed and some things haven't. And it's just, like, I don't know, it was very, like, powerful to watch, like, in this current time and period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you're just like, oh, yeah, we still have a long way to go.
Yeah. I've been feeling that with almost everything I watch or play or read. Like, it's just, like, everything is like, oh, yep, things are still shitty.
Yeah. That's very true. I mean, I guess that's why I like Empire, because I don't have to think about it at all. You kind of need some of that. Like, I was having that, like, discussion with some of my coworkers where they were like, I don't know what to watch now because I feel bad watching, like, escapist television and movies and stuff.
Oh, but you need it.
Yeah, but I'm like, you kind of, like, you have to be able to, like, detach, because otherwise you're going to exhaust yourself from, like, worrying so much. Like, you can't just, like, watch serious stuff. So, as you can see, I have watched some serious stuff, but also some very escapist things. And I just wanted to mention Split, which is, like, Shyamalan's last movie. And that movie is not very good. And I don't know why. I thought, I was tricked, and people said it was going to be good. And, like, people were like, oh, yeah, he has his, like, comeback now. And, like, he's, like, going to make good movies now.
I feel like that happens with, like, every M. Night movie. Everyone's like, oh, it's going to be great. And then, ugh.
The premises are always good.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, because I watched, like, last year, I watched, one of my favorite movies was, like, 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Which was, that was good.
Super good and really tense and such a cool, like, reveal, and the characters are great. And Split, like, kind of takes a lot of the same things and then makes them boring. And you're just like, this is ridiculous. Why would this, like, it's just, like, such a waste of, I don't know, it's just, like, it's just unnecessary, basically. Like, he could have made it really interesting. But I think he's just a bad director. And that's all there is to it.
And isn't Split about dissociative identity disorder? Like,
yeah, that too. It is about dissociative identity disorder.
Okay.
It is very problematic because it basically says that, like, having, you know, dissociative identity disorder means that you're dangerous. And it's like, no, that's, you're just, like, increasing the stigma against, like, mental illness. Like, you're not giving me a good, like, portrayal here. It's just very cartoony and, like, literally like a comic where his, like, basically his, like, identities change his, like, body chemistry. So he didn't, like, so, like, his, like, more evil ones actually make him stronger. And you're just like, ooh, this is just, like, really weird. This is a strange, like, yeah, literally, like, makes him to a monster, and you're like, oh, no, that's bad.
Step away.
Yeah. I blame my friend who dragged me to go see it. I was like, never again. I'm not going to watch a Shyamalan movie. Yeah. That's pretty much what I've been looking at.
Okay. Riley, what have you been up to?
Well, I finally went back and played the Mystic Messenger Christmas DLC. Because the first time that I played it, I got, quote, the bad ending.
Oh, no.
Where I ended up with the unknown character.
Oh.
Mystery. And he, like, kidnaps you? Yeah, it was weird, and I didn't like it. Okay. So I, like, put it down, and then came back to it the other day because I heard that the route that you can take with Jaehee, one of the, like, the only woman character, you can actually, like, the end of it is actually just, like, it doesn't avoid you two having a relationship this time.
Oh, okay.
So it happens, like, on Christmas. There's, like, a big party that's happening or whatever, and then Jaehee's route kind of ends with you, like, going to the office where she is, and she's, like, asleep in the chair, and you can kiss her on the cheek, and I was so happy. I was like, yay. And then she, like, mentions that she had this dream that you came to the office, and then she's like, and I hope we can actually, like, be like that in the future. And it's like, good. So, yeah, that was really cute. And then Heroes of the Storm and Overwatch both had their Lunar New Year events.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the extra modes that they kind of added in each game, well, I guess Overwatch has, like, the extra mode, and HOTS has, like, at the beginning of a match, there's this, like, rooster race, and you bring the rooster gifts to make it go faster than, like, the enemy rooster.
Oh, okay.
And it's bullshit.
Oh.
Even though they fixed it, it's still bullshit. It's really difficult to win still. And they changed it so you only have to complete the race, you don't have to win anymore to get the objective completed. So yeah, and like if everybody doesn't participate, it's really difficult to do it. So it's, yeah, I don't like it. But I like the new skins and stuff. They're really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't do the Overwatch event, the Capture the Flag.
Yeah.
Because I've heard it's also very shitty.
It is. It is shitty. I didn't like it at all. I did one and then I was like, nope, I'm done.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's like you set up turrets and stuff and it's like impossible to win. Or you have like a diva that can go across the map and cap the flag really quickly, or Sombra or something, and that doesn't do it for me. I don't like when it feels like there's no chance that you can win, like you're kind of going up against something that it doesn't even matter how hard you try.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. But then it, like, again, the Lunar New Year skins are so cute, and I love D.Va's so much. Her little hanbok is, like, adorable. And I haven't gotten, like, any skins at all, except, no, I don't think I've gotten a single new skin.
Oh, no.
And I haven't bought loot boxes because I was like, no, this time I'm not going to, but I really like some of the skins this time, so I might buy loot boxes.
I'm totally into the skins too.
Yeah, they're so good.
Yeah, they're good. I think this is what I was saving my gold for, since I just missed the ending of the last two events, so I didn't buy any skins. But so I'm thinking I'll probably buy the May ones. Hopefully they fix them.
Oh yeah,
I got a really pretty Mercy one. I think that's the only thing I've got so far.
Oh, maybe I do have the Mercy one. That might be the only one that I've got, but. Yeah, I don't know.
It's no D.Va, come on.
I know!
Yeah,
hers is the best one!
I don't play D.Va, so.
Yeah, I mean, like, I play her sometimes. I play Zarya more than I play D.Va.
Actually, I play a lot of Zenyatta, so, and his skin is pretty good. So.
Oh, yeah, his skin is good. I like his, because the last couple ones, like, I did not like the Nutcracker one at all.
No,
I find
it's so
it really creepy.
It's so creepy. Yeah.
My favorite thing about that skin are, like, all of the memes that have come out of it, like, experience festivity, or, like, experience these nuts.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. I haven't even seen those.
They're so good. And, like, even Zenyatta's new one, people are like, well, he's super attractive now.
Yeah.
I did hear that.
Like, he's a robot,
that
guys.
Because it's like, he wasn't fuckable before, but now.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, what? I guess he has a face. I guess it makes it better.
Yeah, the difference is his face.
And lots of contouring.
Yeah, that's right. And then aside from the minimal amount of gaming that I've been doing, this week in Riley's K-drama corner, I'm still watching Hwarang, and the reason that I'm mentioning it is because they're halfway through the season, and it's just the one season that's planned for it. But because of the Lunar New Year, they're releasing like a catch-up episode where the first 12 episodes are going to be kind of like condensed, and like all of the main points are going to be put into this special event, so you can kind of catch up to the show, which is good because the episodes they're an hour long, so it's a lot if you're trying to catch up on it. And I haven't been able to find it online yet, but I'm sure it'll pop up, and I'll link it when I find it if anybody's interested in watching it. But it's finally getting, like, there's like good reveals happening and love triangles and political scheming. It's so good. And then I started watching this other one. It's called Goblin, the Lonely and Great God, which is also, the episodes are very long. They're like an hour and 20 minutes. And it's a lot different than Hwarang, because Hwarang is kind of like a pseudo-historical drama, and Goblin is more like a supernatural kind of thing, where there's a girl that can see ghosts. And it's kind of set in the current time, like today. And there are like Grim Reapers, and they have to like fill out paperwork for each like soul that they escort across to the other side. And the goblin in question is kind of the main character. The story kind of revolves around him. And he's only in this world still because he's got this like curse put upon him that he can't die until somebody pulls the sword from his chest, and the only way that he can get that to happen is when he meets his, I think they call her the goblin's bride, so once he meets her, then he can like die essentially. But like, yeah, it's really sad.
He's got a sword
too
in his chest?
Yeah,
the whole time. That sucks.
Yeah, it's like he, so like in his first life, I guess, he was a general and died from a sword being in his chest, and then his spirit like attached onto the sword, and now he's connected with the sword.
Very Transistor.
Yeah. So it's really neat. I really like the mythical stuff that kind of comes with it, because I guess in Korean folklore, there's like lots of stories about goblins in particular, and like all the secondary characters are really good, and it's really funny, and at the same time, it's got some good like emotional moments. So I'm really, really enjoying that show. So yeah, that's all I've been up to.
Is the goblin bride supposed to be like his true love?
Yeah.
So once he meets her, then he dies?
Yep. That's why it's so sad.
Does he want to meet her?
So where I'm at in the story, he's met her. And he's kind of going through this like, well, I wanted to die for the last like 900 years, but now I don't.
Oh, snap.
So, yeah. And now he's kind of like at this, you know, crossroads. And then, you know, for her to live, he has to die. And for him to live, she would have to die. So it's like,
that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
That's, yeah, it's great. Yeah, I love it a lot. But yeah, that's all I've been up to. I've like buried myself in Korean dramas, and I don't do anything else.
No, your Twitter feed is all pretty Korean boys.
Yep. I mean, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. Whatever gets you through the day.
Yeah, at this point. Yep. Yeah. What about yourself, Pam?
I've been playing a few things. I just picked up XCOM 2 again. I had played it on PC when it first came out, and I decided to go ahead and grab it on Xbox because I would rather play it on console. So I started a new campaign, and I've already put like 20 hours or something ridiculous into it the last couple days. It was kind of strange because I rewatched Arrival last night. So I was playing XCOM on the TV, and I had Arrival going on my laptop. So it was this weird juxtaposition of like, these aliens are friendly, let's try to communicate with them, versus like, these aliens are bad, let's shoot them.
Which are the good ones?
Yeah. Other than that, I've been playing Tyranny sort of on and off. I love CRPGs, but I was really excited for this one coming out, and then it came out the week of, like, a few days after the election, and the whole premise of the game is that evil has won, and you're working for this evil warlord guy, and so, you know, it sort of put me off it for a little while, and then I started playing it, but I can only take it in small doses, because even though it's like, this is just a video game, I'm not really doing evil, it's still like, I don't want to do the bidding of this evil dude. I'd rather go like save some puppies or something.
It's good training.
Yeah. And then I also played the new King's Quest game, the one that came out, I think it was last year. I was never a huge King's Quest fan. Originally, I played a couple of them. I really liked 7, I think, which is one where you play as Rosella and Valenice. But I started playing this new one, and it's sort of like every time it started to endear itself to me, it would do something to ruin it. Okay. So the first episode, there's 5 episodes, was 7 or 8 hours long, which was way too long. There was also a lot of backtracking in the game, which is something that was definitely in the original series, but it's like, go 8 screens and pick up this thing, and then go back 12 screens and use it on this thing, and then there was just so a lot of back and forth and sort of wasted time. Mm-hmm. I feel like that would have been okay for me in adventure games, you know, 20 years ago, but now it's just like, I don't have the patience for this, but I did manage to finish it. I just wasn't a huge fan. I also watched The Girl with All the Gifts, which was a book. I read the book not too long ago, and it's about, it's basically a post-apocalyptic zombie movie, except, minor spoiler alert, the children, like child zombies, don't act like zombies. Like, they can think and talk and reason, but they also like have this craving for flesh that people have learned to stave off through use of some gel that like covers their human scent. But it's all about this girl, and she is like totally infatuated with her teacher because her teachers are there trying to teach the zombies and see if there's any way that they can sort of turn them back or see if they can be used to create some kind of cure for things. And it was pretty good. I liked the movie. It was sort of pretty similar to the book. I think they cut out some stuff from the book that wasn't all that good. So...
And the teachers are humans?
Yeah, the teachers are humans.
Okay. So there's like a human survivor community.
Yeah.
I see.
So they've got in the sort of like military base, so they've got scientists who are trying to find some kind of cure or vaccine for the zombie virus. And it's the same thing that they use in The Last of Us, that the like brain parasite thing.
Mm. Sounds fun. I like the idea, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And then another movie I watched was Obvious Child, which is about a girl who, she's a stand-up comedian, and she breaks up with her boyfriend, or her boyfriend breaks up with her at the beginning of the movie, and then eventually she has a one-night stand with a guy, and she gets pregnant, and it's all about sort of what she's going to do. because she doesn't want to be a mother. So it's nice that, because I feel like a lot of media doesn't really talk about abortions at all, or like it presents them as some kind of bad idea, whereas this was just like, yeah, a lot of people do this. It's a thing that happens. And I did watch this on the same day that they were doing that March for Life, just sort of as a as my little mini protest.
Yeah.
And then I listened to the Black Tapes podcast, which I listened to Limetown a couple weeks ago, and that was so amazing that I've been looking for other podcasts like it. So the Black Tapes is all about the paranormal. It's this journalist who is, you know, open to alternate possibilities and things. And she's working with this guy, Dr. Strand, who is a big skeptic. And it goes through all of his sort of case files and things. And it's pretty good. I like it, but I don't love it like I did with Limetown. So I'm still on the hunt for more, even though I listened to the whole two seasons.
Well, podcasts are easy that way. You just like listen forever.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I got through them really quick. I think there was 24 episodes, and I got through them all in a couple weeks. So I don't know how I have all this time. 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah, okay. That's like the Limetown ones you said were 20.
Yeah.
So that's not too bad. Mm-hmm. That's like a one-way drive for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if you think about it that way, I could listen to two on my way to and from work, so. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that brings us to our main topic for this week, which is Arrival. If you don't know, Arrival is a fairly recent movie. It's about a sort of alien, well, not an invasion, but aliens arrive at Earth at 12 different spots around the globe, and our main character, Louise, is a linguist, and she's brought in to try to communicate with them and understand what they are, what they're here for. So what originally brought up this topic is an article that Yusuf wrote, which is called Mass Effect Arrival and Social Responsibility in Sci-Fi. Yusuf, do you want to tell us a little bit about sort of what made you write the article and sort of the main thesis of it for people who haven't read it?
Sure. And obviously, this will spoil a lot of Arrival.
Yeah.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. Big spoilers.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had just seen Arrival, and I forgot how it came up, but I was just seeing some of like the similar conversations that have like about Mass Effect and how, especially in the first game, like you just have some crewmates who are super xenophobic. Like there's Ashley, and then there's Presley, the navigator. Mm-hmm. And just like how that's really interesting, where like how that contrasts with your mission, with the thrust of the game, because it just always seems like there's not a lot of ambiguity there. It's like your character is like, hey, we're gonna work with aliens. Like, you're being stupid. Like, why don't you want to work with aliens? Like, what are you doing here if you don't want to work with aliens? Mm-hmm. That kind of like led me to think about it more. And with Arrival, the big conflict of the game, of the movie, is I guess between like scientists and intellectuals and like the government, who I think they do a good job at showing basically the almost the impossible situation the government is in, because it's like exists to like, or the military specifically exists to protect the countries and the world essentially from any kind of attack. So like they're going to be in the defensive, and like Luis and the other scientists like don't have to consider that, and they actually can try and think of it more purely as an intellectual problem, as an academic problem. So there's this conflict between a military that can't understand what the aliens want, because it can't afford to open up that vulnerability, especially with other nations. And that was a big thing too, where like the different scientists like just in the movie want to work together, and then the government's kind of shut that down. Which is like, it's literally happening with our government, with the U.S. government, where like they are like trying to keep the EPA and other organizations from broadcasting their findings and their studies, which is just incredibly horrifying. And yeah, so like, and you just see this like big conflict between insularity, defensiveness, and then like a quest, like a desire for knowledge, a desire for communication, and like, and working together. And framing that around Mass Effect, you just see a lot of the same concepts come out. Again, the first game is really the main Mass Effect that kind of presents these conundrums in like very clear ways, because like it's the game that is about finding out there's a big threat, figuring out like how the different races are going to react to it, and then also the role of humanity in all of this. Like, humanity is this upstart civilization, like they just joined the Citadel races, and like there's a lot of like grumbling among the other aliens, like that they're getting like kind of fast-tracked forward just because of like these different these like extenuating circumstances. So like it just brings all these to light. The council itself is like very, very reticent and dismissive of like kind of addressing the danger that the Reapers present, and like are kind of like just kind of getting in your way a lot of the time. And that's something that exists in all three of the games, I guess. The council is always like dragging its feet. So a lot of it's like your character Shepard is like, no, we have to like take action, we have to do this, that, and then like the council kind of being like, well, you know, like they're just like much more conservative in how they approach these basically complete unknown variables, which makes sense, but it's also frustrating. So it's like the same thing with like the military in Arrival. Like, you know, you get where they're coming from, but it's also like, just let Luis solve it, because she's clearly going to do it, because it's a movie. Yeah, so that's kind of like, where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I really liked that. I think we've talked about Mass Effect. Well, we talk about Mass Effect almost every episode now.
It's not going to change because the new one comes out really soon.
But we talked about how it was nice that humans aren't, you know, the ones in charge. They aren't the sort of stars of the show. I mean, though Shepard is, and she's a human. As you said, humans are like this upstart race, and they're not even particularly respected by the other aliens. And in so much media, it's either very human or very like USA centric, and it's like it's shown as them, like the humans or the Americans, like they know best and they're here and they're gonna save us all, whereas everyone else is sort of seen as like almost a hindrance to that.
Sure. No, it's definitely true. Like even like Star Trek is like the humans humans are kind of taking the, I mean, they have aliens on board, but they're like, it's not, you know, they're just like they're sidekick. Whereas, like, at least in the beginning of Mass Effect, you're just like, they're just like, who the hell are you?
Yeah, I think that's kind of cool, because I can see why it is that way, especially with the human part of it, because, you know, that's the experience we know. So, of course, we're going to sort of write from that point of view. So what I really liked about especially that first Mass Effect was that it tried to flip it around a little bit.
And speaking of, like, Andromeda, that also kind of gave me some impetus to write the piece, because ultimately a lot of this is conjecture, because we don't know how the game's going to play. They keep a lot of it very secretive. It very much seems like the humans are still like the ones in charge, or at least like of that one of the main like branch of the fleet that is landing there. Does it have the same amount of like politicking and like questioning your role as the ones who get to decide everything as the earlier Mass Effect games?
Yeah, like we haven't really seen anything that involves talking to any other species except for like the brief blip in the cinematic trailer that just came out. But it's just like walking forward and meeting them. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the recent trailer definitely has the most information about that particular aspect of it. And it has like, in your crewmates are all like the similar like aliens from the earlier series, and it's really cool to see like the different kinds of, like, you're going to get to see more kinds of the aliens that you previously were allied with. So they're there, you know, like female Turian is like really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited about that.
Hopefully she doesn't get as hosed as the first female Turian that we got to see.
So going back to Arrival, I just watched it a couple weeks ago for the first time, and I really loved how they did it. Like, compared to most movies where aliens arrive, I felt like this was very different. It did a number of things that I liked. The first thing was the huge focus on language and how important that would be. And the second thing that they did, which most don't, is that they made the aliens very alien. Like, in so much media, they are basically humanoid from the other side of the galaxy. Whereas in this, there was no commonality. Like, there wasn't any, like, gestures or body languages or sounds that were anything human-like to give the humans and the aliens, like, a point of, you know, connection or common understanding. So it was basically like having to start from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw like when they like first came out and they were like with their little 7 feet or whatever, and I was like, they kind of look like trees. Which, like,
they do.
How would you even go about starting to talk to trees?
Like, where's the face?
Beings. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I like that. I kind of thought that they look like hands, just with seven fingers.
Yeah.
Did it? Yeah. I really also like how they like hide the rest of them from view. So they're just like,
yeah.
When they first come on, you're like, is it just their feet? Like, because it's basically just like a bunch of limbs that just descend from above, and you're just like, where's the rest? And that's a really interesting way to portray an alien, mm-hmm. where you're just like, why would they just be a body? Like, why? Or one or individual bodies, like, could they possibly be like this gigantic thing? Like, the ships are big.
Yeah, that's true. There's definitely a more of a sense of mystery around them, and it sort of persisted the whole way through the movie. Yeah, I just really liked how they portrayed those aliens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I about that particular part. Have you read the Annihilation books, or the Southern Reach trilogy?
No.
It's like the series of books that came out that were released a few years ago. And this is the science fiction trilogy that's like really, really interesting because it's about aliens, but they never show the aliens.
Hmm.
And it's basically like the whole book revolves around this like small bubble of land in like a part of like North America that basically in some way or another, interacted with the aliens. So it ends up being like very like, so it's just a very like, everything changed very slightly, but it's all about this different scientists and government officials trying to figure out exactly what changed. And so it's extremely mysterious and like just holds a lot back, and like it's just like a really fascinating read because it's, I don't know, it just feels more real in terms of like human interaction with aliens, because it's about like, why do we assume that we can understand what they are? Like, the whole, the Arrival also really, like, dives into this, where it's like, wouldn't it make sense for an alien to be impossible to comprehend for our brains?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, because we're just, like, not used to, like, to seeing that. So, like, this kind of, I feel like, Arrival totally has the same thing, where it's like, you're just, like, struggling to get to square one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like how when like, the commander was kind of saying to Louise, like, you need to ask them, like, what their purpose is. And then she goes to the whiteboard and she just writes it down. Then she explains, well, first we need to get them to understand what Earth is. Like, that's where we are. And then she's like, and then we need to differentiate between a singular you and then, like, the plural you. And then they have to understand purpose and
what, like, a question is.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I thought that was so good. And it was like, well, of course, because, like, why would they even know that? And of course, like, the army's prerogative is to understand what they want, like, if they're dangerous, but Louise's is more, you know, being able to communicate with them properly, because especially with English, like, some words can mean different things depending on how you say them. And even when they were talking about, like, the word weapon, it could also be a tool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. Like, I like hearing, you know, stuff like that where the meaning could be different depending how you phrase it. So
when they got to that part of the movie where the aliens were saying offer weapon, I was thinking, like, who taught them that word? Why did you use that word?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's not surprising, I guess, especially considering how, like, the military was so involved in these, that weapon would be a word that they would try to communicate quickly. But, you know, it just really does give you, put a certain image in your mind when it could very well mean tool. And based on what it ended up being, it was, you know, it was tool or an instrument of helping and not hurting. But as Yusuf just said, the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is something that comes up in the movie. And that basically says that your language influences how you see the world, which I think sounds pretty straightforward and sounds to me like it makes sense. Although in the movie, they do take it sort of to a whole other level where learning a new language can, like, rewire how you see the world, which isn't, I don't think that's particularly based in fact. And I think that's definitely an extension of what the actual hypothesis is.
Yeah, it's definitely like a dramatic conceit necessary.
Yeah.
To make the movie work.
I've had that experience, not like, definitely not like what the movie portrayed. In high school, I lived in France for 3 months, like on a school exchange. So I mean, like, I was definitely dreaming in French and like, always like talking in French and like barely ever used English. And then when I got back to Canada, I could like, it took me a while to like form sentences and stuff. So I mean, I can see, like, I can see what they were going for, but like in this case, it was really different. I didn't have any time travel dreams, so
that's too bad. That would be really cool.
Yeah, I wish.
I don't think French is that powerful.
No.
Yeah, I agree though. Like, I think it's really like, yeah, it's very straightforward and makes total sense. Like, my example is, my mother speaks Arabic, and then like, and she lives in Tunisia. So I go to Tunisia every now and then to visit family, and like, I don't speak it fluently, but I like exchange a few words here and there, just like greetings, like how are you, and like in Arabic, like when you're like how are you, the response is praise God, and like that was like, always like a big stumbling block for me, just because I'm like, you know, not religious, and but then the thing is like, it's just, that's just how it's done. It's like the kind of when in Rome thing where it's like. If you want to be understood, and like if you want to like easily be understood, then you should use the words that will work, even if it's like a different worldview from yours. And for me, yeah, it's totally like what both the movie and I think my experience like speaking Arabic's like, where it's like, yeah, like I'm embracing a different worldview to be understood better.
Yeah, and there's like cultural things that come across too with language, especially like idioms and like different phrases and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's like sarcasm, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, my wife's mom doesn't speak English very well. Like, she's from Hong Kong and she doesn't understand sarcasm.
Oh.
Sarcasm's a hard thing for even native English speakers to grasp sometimes.
It's like, what if the aliens in Arrival are really sarcastic? That would make it so much more difficult to understand what they were talking about.
Yeah. What if those names, Abbott and Costello, was more of a reflection of their personalities?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, as I watched it, because I watched it again last night, and I just picked up so many things, and I just find the movie is so well done. Like, when they first see the symbols that the aliens are making and how they go into, like, their language is non-linear and all of the things are in the form of a circle. So I didn't even pick up on it the first time I watched it, how it's like, oh, this is foreshadowing the whole time component of the movie later on.
Time is a flat circle.
Time is a flat circle.
No, yeah, I agree. It's like, it's very much, I think the art direction for that is brilliant. Like, because that was like separate from the script, apparently. for the book, because it was based on like a, I guess a, some, I think it was a,
like a short story
or short story.
A short story, yeah.
Yeah, and then I heard that that was not in the short story, and like they kind of made that for the movie, and it makes sense because like you need a more visual way to express like how alien their language is, and the fact that they made it both visually alien and also like very plot, very relevant to the plot, was pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was really, really great how they did that. I also liked how they sort of threw different kinds of experts at the problem. So they had the linguist, but then they also had, I think he was a physicist or a mathematician, something like that. The second guy.
Jeremy Renner.
Jeremy Renner, yeah. I liked how...
Unfortunate Jeremy Renner.
Yeah. I liked him in this. I just don't like him.
Yeah, yeah.
In real life.
Yeah, pretty much.
just because I think that's a good thing, too. I mean, having something like math or science as an additional way to communicate or understand, it sort of reminds me of, I think it was the Voyager mission, where they sent up, where NASA sent up all this sort of content out into space, and it had music, and it had brain waves, and it had Morse code, and it had like actual like 50 different languages of people saying greetings. So it's cool, it's all the different ways that you can think of communicating that aren't necessarily verbal language.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Like, they probably looked at that as reference.
Probably, yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, I think, I guess the supposition was that math would be the more universal language, which I get, even though I'm terrible at math.
Yeah, so. Same. Me too.
I can't fully be on board with that. But I get it.
Well, even the numbers, like the 12 different ships that came, arrived, like 12 is a pretty important number in terms of time, which also is another little hint to where the movie is getting.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Hmm.
Should have rewatched it, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost like this like very big puzzle for the scientists to solve.
Mm-hmm.
It also reminded me of the beginning of the Stargate movie, where they're like looking at that disc, and then everyone's like, I don't get it, the disc. And then like the guy, what's his name, comes in, Daniel, and it's like, oh yeah, it's hieroglyphic.
Oh. No problem, like, I got this.
Yeah, and he's got it. He totally got it. It's like a lot more of like a braggadocious, like annoying nerd dude version of how to solve the problem of communication. When I think about it, there is a lot of similarities with Stargate, where it's like, yeah, like all about trying to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
And like his linguistic knowledge of hieroglyphics in the present helps understand. Because the idea in Stargate is like these ancient hieroglyphics are a root language for both like the Earth's version and aliens version.
Mm-hmm.
So like the language was actually like shifting like over time and like space. So that's pretty cool. Kind of a tangent.
That's okay.
Yeah. The movie also reminded me a lot of Contact.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen.
Because it, you know, Contact's another movie with like the idea of aliens that are beyond our comprehension and Earth governments being annoying and like conservative and like dragging their feet and trying to help you.
Mm-hmm.
You're just like, I'm just trying to be a scientist here.
Yeah.
Let me be a scientist. And then like the government is just like kind of being like, no, you know, too risky, too hard. It's just like such an interesting like problem to face, where governments, like, it makes sense that governments exist and have to protect us and like keep society and keep like civilization running.
Mm-hmm.
But that can often be like, you know, at the detriment of science.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
Like, yeah, science is like, I mean, you know, arguably a very dangerous, like, often a very dangerous, like, road to travel down. Like, nuclear weapons were scientists trying to, like, figure out why atoms work the way that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found out and, like, created, like, the tool for our, you know, potentially the end of our species.
Yeah, that sort of brings up two different ways that sort of the government and the military screw things up. The first one is in having like such a fear of the unknown and assuming that everyone is out to get you that they're trying to like rush along Louise. Like they don't want to give her time to teach the alien, you know, basic pronouns or kindergarten language because they just want to know immediately, like, what are you doing here? Are you going to attack us? How can we use you to the best of our knowledge? But at the same time, the government screwing things up by being so secretive, because as you see, and I think it's pretty cool that it's contrasted, like when you see Louise with aliens, everything is quite serene and beautiful, but those glimpses that we get of like the real world and people are panicking and rioting because they don't know what's going on, and it makes it clear that no one's telling them anything that they've learned at all this time.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's almost like, could you like look at a movie like War of the Worlds or something and then think that there's like a part of that world, or like Independence Day, where like the government is just like having a nice chat with the aliens.
Yeah.
And like not telling anybody anything.
Yeah. And then that sort of fear and lack of knowledge is what ends up causing, I guess it was some of the military dudes that were lower on the hierarchy who ended up killing one of the aliens.
Oh, yeah. I had no idea that the bomb that they planted actually like was the cause of one of the aliens' death until I looked at your article.
Oh.
And I was like, of course that's what killed him. Oh my god, I'm so dumb. Gosh.
No, I mean, it takes a second for it to sink in because they're so direct about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I had no idea. And then I was like, of course that was it.
Yep.
No.
To be fair, I'm pretty sure I had to talk to my friends afterwards to like get that. to figure it out. Like we were like talking after the movie and I was like, oh yeah. Because it could also like be, you know, maybe the alien just has a short lifespan.
Yeah, I thought he was older or something. I was like, oh, that's sad. He's
died of natural causes.
Yeah, yeah.
He came all this way to Earth only to die.
Yeah.
Natural causes.
Why'd they send the old guy? They should send a younger
Oh, yay, yay.
But that part was like, I guess arguably the most on-the-nose part because soldiers were watching the equivalent of, like, Alex Jones or something.
Fresh Limbo, yeah.
Just like, those aliens are bad, they're devil to devil, kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they're just, like, kind of, represent essentially, like, the right wing of our nation, of the U.S. They're just fearful of anything that's different. It's, like, very much, like, standing in the way of progress in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found that, like, when they were showing the soldiers listening to those clips, and I was like, oh boy, this is, like, uncomfortably similar to the situation that's going on right now.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, like, in the States and, like, here in Canada. So I was like, who? Like, extremely timely, but also really uncomfortable. But at the same time, like, you can see how that happens. Like, stuff like that is so accessible. To so many people. So, and then I found the moment too where they kind of, Louise and what's his face, Ian, like went back up into the ship after they had put the bomb there, and they were talking to them, and then at one point one of the aliens like taps on the glass, and it was like they were trying to figure out what that was because they've never like done that before with them in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Like tapping on the glass to like get them to look behind them. And I was like, they're not gonna know, they're gonna die. even though it killed one of the aliens, they still like made the effort to save Louise and Ian.
Yeah,
which I thought was kind of interesting because they could have just like, I don't know, let them die there. But why would they let Louise and Ian die when they've been nothing but, you know, kind and trying to communicate with them? So
mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really nice, kind of like a beautiful moment where they saved those two and sacrificed one of the aliens for them. So
yeah.
Well, they displayed more humanity than the humans did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I was kind of surprised that didn't come up more about how like one of the aliens specifically sort of sacrificed himself to save the humans, and no one went, oh gee, maybe they're not so bad. Like,
yeah.
Wasn't it kind of at that point, it was already like at this tipping point dramatically?
Yeah.
Everybody was mobilizing, and that was when like Luis like took the one, basically went into the chamber, which was a very interesting part as well.
Mm-hmm.
I found, just because like that was the only part where she like, they just start having like a natural conversation.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that gets into sort of the ending of the movie. So we've been talking spoilers all the way through, but major spoiler, the language allows humans to see time like the aliens do, which is basically all happening at once, so they can be experiencing the past, the present, and the future all in one go. So I figure when we had that scene of Louise in the pod with them, she was being able to like access that future knowledge of the language in order to communicate them with them.
Yeah, that makes sense. It was also very strange.
Yes.
Yeah.
But time travel is always really hard to wrap your head around.
It is. Yeah. Although I found that this was more easy to grasp than a lot of other movies, which brings me to one of our listener questions from a Latino lawyer who asks a very leading question. Wasn't this less convoluted and therefore way better than Interstellar?
Objection.
Yeah. Wait one second.
I mean, yeah, it was like, I don't know. Less convoluted. I don't know. Like, eh.
Yeah, I mean, I liked Interstellar. But yeah, I do agree that the ending is very, I mean, it definitely, like, it's not just about, like, time travel, and it's also about, like, dimensionality, which makes it very, like, you're just, like, it definitely took a second, like, viewing of Interstellar to understand fully what was happening.
Yeah.
Or more fully. Whereas with Arrival, I definitely, like, got it, you know? Like, it is really just about her being able to see through time, and then that unlocking everything else in the movie.
Yeah.
But I did feel that, okay, this kind of... This is kind of an answer to the first question, which is the ending of Arrival good? By X Huggles X.
Yeah.
And I do feel that there was some weakness there in terms of, like, how easily they solved everything, because she uses time travel to learn to create this recursive loop with the Chinese military general guy and, like, find out both his phone number from the future and like his wife says to him.
Yeah.
I was like, dang, that's really convenient.
It's super convenient. And I guess it's supposed to like show the power of time travel. You can find out so much stuff. But it's almost like it stretches the ability of the narrative to tell a coherent story or to tell like a reasonable story, because it's like, at some point you're like, time travel is too powerful. Like, what's going to happen now? Like, is every person able to time travel to understand the language, or just
every
see the
person
future?
That figures out the language? Yeah,
like that has like such dramatic effects for everything down the line.
Yeah,
and you can. I couldn't really in the end. Like, I couldn't really think about it too much, because I was like, you know what? It's fine.
Hurts the brain meets.
Yeah, and you're like, let's just think. I mean, as long as you like, I think you really have to like focus down on her own story.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, this is like, okay, I get it in terms of like the dramatic necessity of her story, where she basically finds out that she's going to have a child and that child's going to die and there's no way they could save it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, she's also going to marry Jeremy Renner.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a weird romance where like, you know, you're going to marry somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I think that the ending worked for me. Again, I did sort of focus down on Louise's story, because you have like this big, like, world-changing event where she's able to go into the future and get the guy's phone number and his wife's last words. But then you've also got all the time all of these little events that are showing how this, like, time thing is being used, like when the daughter asks her for a word for a certain thing, and then in the present Jeremy Renner says what it is and she's able to like give her the answer. So it's like affecting all kinds of things from very, very small to very, very large. But I agree that anytime you get into time travel, there are paradoxes which are difficult to wrap your head around. But I did like the ending of this, and I did like Arrival a lot more than Interstellar, although I have to say I was kind of bored with Interstellar, so my attention near the end wasn't completely there, which is probably has something to do with how little I understood it.
Yeah, that's fair. That's totally fair.
Yeah.
I mean, Interstellar, I feel like, was somewhat more at war with itself in the message it was trying to get across, which was ultimately that love is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, halfway through the movie, Matthew McConaughey is like, love sucks. Anyway, stop being a ridiculous woman and, like, follow me to planets or whatever. This planet's the best one. But then he ends up being wrong. And then, like, but I don't know. Like, I feel like that muddies the message a bit. Because, yeah, it's like, I don't know. With Arrival, like, I feel like Luis is very consistent throughout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's in it for the knowledge. She's like, she feels very powerfully about this. She like, I mean, from to the extent that she even like, you know, volunteered right off the bat and like wanted to do this because like something drew her to it. It felt more like kind of a coherent journey that was, I don't know, just like less conflicted by some of the more like, trying to say like parts of science are just very like obnoxious and very like know-it-all.
Yeah.
And I feel like parts of Interstellar have those elements just because of the director. Like Nolan is just very much like a cold director who's like very bad at handling human emotions.
Yeah.
And like Interstellar definitely has that problem. And then I think Arrival like is a lot more about marrying the emotion and the scientific elements of it in a way that really come through.
Yeah, I think that's a good explanation. And I think just everything in Arrival just fits together really nicely. Like once you've know all the answers, and especially on my second viewing, it was just like everything was so very well plotted and it all came together very nicely. You know, once you start thinking beyond the story that it's telling, then it gets, you know, a little mind screwy. But in terms of what they actually showed, I was pretty happy with it.
I found, like, unlike with some other time travel movies, is I never felt like I was being treated like I wasn't smart enough to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was like, oh, okay, cool, like, I see what's going on here, and then you can kind of connect a little more, especially, like, the lead character, Louise, was really easy to, like, she was very believable, very, like, you know, some, like, an actual person that you could see, like, being in the world right now.
Yeah, she's like an academic and this is an interesting topic of study.
Mm-hmm.
Like who wouldn't want to do this?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she like gets to the place, and I loved it, like that introductory scene where they fly over the field and they show the ship and like the tiny little scientists like dotted around the field.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a visually powerful image to show. Like I thought that was really well done. But then she's like also like she's like, oh, maybe I bit off more than I can chew here.
Yeah.
Like all the other scientists are like, oh yeah, everyone like vomited or left or like had like mental breakdowns.
Okay, so we have one more question from a Latino lawyer. The aliens come with companions and convey language jointly. What lessons does this movie give about our beliefs on efficiency and teaching if they don't just show a video or learn our language to communicate? And I think this is interesting because I'm pretty sure in the short story that this is based on, it basically was videos that was how the aliens were communicating. It was through videos and they were sort of all over. I think there was more than 12 of them.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right. It might have been in that linguist article. Or, yeah, some article I read.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you're totally right. And that's a really interesting question, for sure. This, it's like an added challenge where like video is very passive. Mm-hmm. Even like the flash forward slash backs to her child didn't hit me as hard as just the interactions between her and the aliens, and just like situating the audience in that room where you're just like, what do these mysterious giant creatures want? You know, like what are they trying to get across?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and like and the idea of having two of them, it both makes it more menacing in some ways, but that was like the original reaction that I had, where it's like, oh, you see one, okay. Oh, the second one just like rolls up.
Yeah.
And like out of nowhere, and you're like, whoa, there's more than one. But I wonder if it's, I don't know. I think in the movie, like, I think it was meant more to convey that the aliens needed a backup alien in case one of them died.
Yeah.
But two is more efficient than one in terms of like teaching.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, that's why, yeah, for sure, have like teaching assistants, because you need that. I mean, you need people with, you need different perspectives. So I don't think the movie ever distinguished the alien identities from each other enough.
Yeah.
For that, to have that reading of it.
I mean, there is a little bit. I mean, in that scene where the bomb goes off, one of the aliens just like books it out of there while the other one stays and saves them. So
that's true. I mean, and we get the kind of different personalities and viewpoints kind of from the human side as well, where they've got like the military people recording everything, and then, you know, like the physicist who's there and the linguist. So like all these people that look at it differently. So it's probably reasonable to assume the aliens are kind of doing the same thing, but
mm-hmm.
we don't get to see their that concrete evidence side that that's happening.
And it could be an extension of, you know, having the 12 different ships out there all communicating with different areas of the planet. I know part of their goal was to make everyone sort of work together in order to figure this out. But it also meant that they were all learning in different ways. Like, I liked how they talked about in China, they were using Mahjong in as a way to communicate, and sort of the different repercussions that had.
Yeah. Like, I really like that too, because it shows that like language, yeah, why do we just assume that English is the best language to translate?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because like, you know, if anything, like it's more difficult because English is like goes linearly from left to right, but then maybe like, you know, since Chinese goes right to left or up to down, like that might have an impact. But they don't really cover that in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But no. that's an interesting way to like look at it, I think.
I would have liked to see how the other different cultures attempted to communicate with their aliens.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that would have been really cool.
But I wonder if it's also, if the two aliens is also like based on their society's like their understanding of teamwork and working together. So they're like, oh yeah, we're gonna work together, so do as we do, or like, you know, like follow our lead.
That's a good point.
You all should work together, because like that's the goal, that's the end goal of this. But yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, I like mm-hmm. that question. All right, does anyone have anything else they want to add before we wrap it up?
I really enjoyed this movie. I'll probably have to watch it a few more times to like pick up some more stuff, but like first viewing of it, I was kind of like fascinated at the way that they took language and the way that they depicted a language that, you know, even though we've got so many different languages and alphabets here on Earth, it seemed alien enough for it to be believable that it was so different that it was like nothing that we'd seen here on Earth, like even in a sci-fi movie. So mm-hmm. I thought, you know, the aliens were really well done. They super reminded me of the Reapers from Mass Effect.
Yeah.
when we finally get to see, like, their full bodies. And, like, I thought the acting was great. And I loved Amy Adams in this. And I just thought it was, like, such a great movie all around. So if you haven't seen it and you listened all the way, why did you do that? But if you know somebody that hasn't seen it, maybe sit down and watch it with them, because, yeah, it was really good. And it was helpful. Like, I watched it with my boyfriend, and it was helpful to have somebody to kind of, like, talk to as it was playing, being like, oh, okay, well, this fits with this. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. And yeah, and I'm glad that we could talk about it today.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Like, I hope more people watch it. Mm-hmm. I feel like, I don't know, it just didn't really ever break into the, like, the zeitgeist of just, like, yeah, people talking about movies.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe when it comes out, like, officially on, like, DVD and stuff, maybe people will clue in. But yeah, it's so good.
Thank you, Yusuf, for joining us and writing that great article.
Thank you. It was a really fun discussion on all fronts.
Yay. Yeah. Do you want to tell people where they can find you?
Sure. I'm YumiYu, YUMEYOU, on Twitter. And that's pretty much a good place to look.
All right.
Yeah.
And I, yeah, read this article and read other articles I've written.
And Riley?
You can find me on Twitter at Kaleri. It's K-A-L-E-R-I with an underscore.
And you can find me on Twitter at Josyla underscore or on YouTube where my channel is called Cannot Be Tamed. And if you have any feedback, questions, people, or topic you'd like to hear on future episodes of the show, you can reach out at MediaMavensCast@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter at _MediaMavens. And please, if you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher so more people can find us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Yeah, I really liked the emphasis on linguistics. I totally forgot what I was going to say. I just had
was it about the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis?
I was going to bring it up later.
Oh, sorry. I was like saying Sapir-Whorf.